When he'd gone in last night to talk to them about his test, I'd been worried. But it looked like he'd gotten in. I wanted to whoop for joy. But there was no way Rick had been late without good reason. This was a kid who scheduled extra time in his day for sneezes when he had a cold. I opened my mouth, but held back at a glance from Cobb.
Sir,
Rig finally said, catching his breath. Elevator. Malfunction. Cobb walked to the side of the room and pushed an intercom button.
Jax, he said. Will you check if there was an elevator malfunction today?
Don't need to check, Captain,
a voice replied through a speaker above the button.
Elevator 103D was down for 2 hours with people trapped inside. It's been giving us trouble for months.
Cobb released the button, then eyed Rig.
They say you got the highest score on the test this year, cadet.
That's what they told me, sir. They called me in, and the admiral gave me an award and everything. I'm so sorry I'm late. I didn't mean to do this, particularly on my first day. I about died when...
Yeah, that'll do,
Cobb said, waving toward one of the seats.
Don't wear out my goodwill, son.
Rig took the seat gladly, but then saw me on the side of the room and gave me a huge thumbs up. We'd made it. Both of us, somehow, with Rig at the top, which was awesome. So at least the test really was fair for him. Cobb walked over to Jerkface's seat, then flipped a switch on the side of the box in the front. A veil of light surrounded the mockpit, silent, shimmering, like a glowing bubble. From inside, Jerkface breathed out a soft but audible prayer to the North Star. I leaned forward in my chair.
It can be disorienting, Cobb said, walking over and turning on Arturo's machine, then Ned's. Though it's no match for actually being in the air, it's a reasonable substitute.
I waited, tense, as he went around the circle, flipping on devices one after another. Each cadet made some audible signal of appreciation, a little gasp or a wow. My heart just about broke as Cobb turned away from the last empty seat and walked toward the front of the room. Then, as if remembering something he'd left behind, he looked over his shoulder at me. I nearly exploded with anticipation. Finally, he nodded toward the empty mockpit. I scrambled out of my seat and climbed in as he flipped the switch. Light flashed around me, and in the blink of an eye, I seemed to be sitting in the cockpit of a Poco-class fighter on a launch pad outside the building. The illusion was so incredible that I gasped, then stuck my hand outside the canopy, just to be sure. The hologram wavered and fell apart into little grains of light, like falling dust, when my hand broke through it. I pulled my hand back in, then inspected the controls. A throttle lever, a dashboard full of buttons, and a control sphere for my right hand. The sphere was a globe I could palm, with grooves for my fingers and buttons at the tips. Outside the holographic cockpit canopy, I could see the other ships in a line beside a picture-perfect reproduction of Alta Base. I could even look up and see the sky, the faint patterns of the rubble belt, everything. Cobb's mustachioed face broke through the sky, like one of the saints themselves, as he leaned in through the hologram to speak with me.
You like the feel of this, cadet?
Yes, sir, I said, more than anything.
Good. Don't lose it.
I met his eyes and nodded. He backed away.
All right, cadets, he said.
His voice felt ghostly, coming from seemingly nowhere.
I don't waste time. Every day you're training is a day good pilots are dying in the fight without you as backup. Put on the helmets at your feet.
I did so, and Cobb's voice now came through the earpiece inside my helmet.
Let's practice takeoffs, he said. That should...
Sir,
Jerkface said. I can show them.
I rolled my eyes.
All right, flight leader,
Cobb said.
I'm willing to let someone else do the hard work for me. Let's see you get them into the sky.
Yes, sir, Jerkface said.
Flight. Your fighters don't need their boosters to raise or lower your altitude. That is handled by the acclivity ring, the hoop-like device underneath every starship. Its power switch is, top of the front console, the red button. Never turn that off when flying, or you'll drop like a piece of debris.
One ship down the line suddenly lit up beneath as the acclivity ring turned on.
Use your control sphere to bank right or left,
Jerkface continued,
or to make small movements. To do a quick ascent, use the smaller lever beside the throttle and pull it upward.
Jerkface's starship lifted into the air in a steady ascent straight up. His ship, like the rest of ours, was a Poco class. They looked like glorified pencils with wings, but they were still starships, and I was in a cockpit. Holographically, kind of almost, but still, it was happening. I flicked the red switch, and my entire dashboard lit up. I grinned, holding the control sphere in my right hand and yanking on the altitude control with my left. My ship sprang backward in a sudden jerking motion, and I managed to crash it into the building behind us. And I wasn't the only one. Our ships responded with far more sensitivity than we were expecting. Rig flipped his completely upside down somehow. Kimmelin darted up into the air, then screamed at the sudden motion and brought herself back down, and flattened right on the launch pad.
Altitude control only, Jerkface said. Don't touch the control sphere right now, cadets.
Cobb chuckled from outside somewhere.
Sir, Jerkface said. That.
He fell silent.
Huh.
I was glad nobody could see how much I was blushing. I appeared to have crashed my ship into a holographic version of the flight school mess hall, judging by the tables and spilled food. I felt as if I should have whiplash, but while my chair shook a little when the ship moved, it couldn't replicate the true motions of flight.
Congratulations, cadets, Cobb said. I'm pretty sure half of you are dead now. Thoughts, flight leader? I didn't expect them to be that hopeless, sir.
We're not hopeless, I said, just eager. And maybe a little embarrassed, Kimmelin noted.
Speak for yourself,
a girl's voice said through my earpiece. What was her name again? Hadia, the ponytailed girl with the loose jacket. She was laughing.
Oh, my stomach. I think I'm going to hurl. Can I do it again?
Again? Kimmelin asked.
It was awesome.
You just said you thought you were going to hurl.
In a good way.
How do you hurl in a good way?
Attention,
Cobb snapped. My ship fuzzed around me, and suddenly all of us were back in a line, our ships whole again, the simulation apparently reset.
Like a lot of new pilots, you're not accustomed to how responsive your ships can be. With the power of the acclivity ring and your booster, you can perform precision maneuvers, particularly once we get you trained with light lances. That versatility comes at a cost, however. It's really easy to get yourself killed in a starship. So today, we're going to practice three things. Going up, coming down, and not dying while you do either. Got it?
Yes, sir, came our chorus.
You're also going to learn to control your radio. The set of blue buttons on the top left of your control panel manages that. You'll need to accustom yourselves to opening a line to the whole flight or to your wingmate alone. We'll go over the other buttons later. I don't want you distracted right now. Stars only know how you could do worse than that little performance you just gave. But I'm disinclined to give you the opportunity.
Yes, sir, we belted out, somewhat sheepishly. And so, for the next 3 hours, we took off and landed. It was frustrating work because I felt like I should be able to do far more. I'd studied so hard, and I'd practiced in my mind. I felt like I knew this. Only I didn't. My crash at the start proved that, and my continuing inability frustrated me. The sole way to overcome that was to practice, so I dedicated myself to the instruction. Up and down, time after time. I did it with gritted teeth, determined not to crash again. Eventually, we all managed to make 5 trips up and down without crashing. As Cobb sent us up again, I leveled at 500 on the altimeter, then stopped myself there. I released a breath, leaning back as the other cadets joined me in a line. Jerkface zoomed past and did a little flip before settling in. Show off.
All right, flight leader, Cobb said. Call your flight roll and get a verbal confirmation of readiness from each member. You'll do this before every engagement to verify that nobody is having mechanical or physical troubles. Flight, if you are experiencing troubles, tell your flight leader. If you fly into battle knowing something is wrong with your ship, then you are responsible for the damage you might cause.
Sir? Bim asked over the line. Is it true that if we crash a real ship while in training, we can't graduate?
Usually, Cobb said. If a cadet crashes their starfighter, it's a sign of some kind of negligence. The type that indicates they shouldn't be trusted with that kind of equipment.
And if we eject? Bim said. I've heard that cadets do training in real combat situations. If we get shot down and eject, does it mean we're out? As a cadet, I mean?
Cobb was silent for a moment.
There's no hard and fast rule, he said.
But it's tradition, right? Bim asked. A cadet who ejects and scuttles their ship stays grounded from then on.
It's because they're looking for cowards, Hadiya said. They want to kick out cadets who are too eager to eject.
I felt a jolt of adrenaline, as I always did when someone mentioned the word coward. But it wasn't in reference to me, and never would be. I would never eject.
Real pilots, said one of Jerkface's cronies. The best of the best. They can steer a crashing ship into a salvageable landing, even if they've been shot. Acclivity rings are worth so much that pilots have to protect them, because the pilot isn't worth as much as...
That's enough, Arturo.
Cobb cut in. You're spreading stupid rumors. Both pilots and ships are valuable. You cadets ignore that talk. You might hear it from other flights about steering your ship into a controlled landing. You hear me? If you're shot down, you eject. Don't worry about the consequences. Worry about your life. If you're a good enough pilot, it won't impact your career, tradition or no tradition.
I frowned. That wasn't what I'd heard. Full pilots who got shot down, they were given second chances. But cadets? Why graduate someone who had been shot down when you were looking for only the very best?
Stupid pilot pride,
Cobb grumbled.
It's cost us more than the Krell have, I swear. Flight leader, weren't you going to call roll?
Oh, right, Jorgen said.
Cadet Flight B, time to...
Cadet Flight B, Cobb said.
You can come up with a better name than that, flight leader.
Yes, sir,
Skyward Flight, I said.
Skyward Flight, Jerkface said, jumping on the name. Roll call and confirmation of readiness in order of dashboard ship identification.
Skyward 2,
said the taller of the two cronies.
Call sign, Netter, confirmed.
Skyward 3, said Hadiya. Call sign, Hurl, confirmed.
Seriously?
Jerkface asked.
Hurl?
Memorable, isn't it?
She asked. Jerkface sighed.
Skyward 4, said Rig. Call sign, Rigmarole.
Wow, it sounds good to say that. And, confirmed.
Skyward 5,
said Arturo, the shorter of the two cronies.
Call sign, Amphisbina.
Ampha what? Hurl asked.
It's a two-headed dragon, Arturo said. It's an extremely fearsome animal from mythology.
Confirmed.
Skyward 6? Kimmelin said. So, call sign. I need one of those, eh?
Saint, I suggested.
Oh, stars, no, she replied.
You can pick one later, Cobb said. Just use your first name for now.
No, she said. Just call me Quick. No need to procrastinate my choice. The saint always said, save time and do that job now.
How? Arturo said. Does doing something now save you any time? Theoretically, the indicated job will take the same amount of time now as it would later.
Tangent, Amphi, Jerkface said. Skyward 7?
Skyward 7, said an accented girl's voice I didn't think I'd heard before. Call sign, Morningtide. Confirmed.
Wait, who was that? I racked my brain. The Vissian girl with the tattoo on her lower jaw, I realized. The one who brushed me off earlier.
Skyward 8, said Bim.
Bim, that's my name, not my call sign. I'll get back to you on that later. I don't want to screw it up. Confirmed, by the way.
Skyward 9, said Freya, the tall blonde girl. Call sign FM. Confirmed.
She'd launched her ship the first time without crashing, the only one who had done that except for Jerkface and his cronies. Her expensive clothing and those golden clasps on her boots made me think she must be from the lower caverns, too. Her family obviously had enough merits for fancy requisitions.
Skyward 10, I said. Call sign Spin. Confirmed.
What a bland call sign, Jerkface said.
I'll be Jaeger. It means hunter in one of the old. Can't be Jaeger, Cobb said. We've already got a Jaeger. Nightmare flight. Just graduated 2 months ago.
Oh, Jerkface said. I didn't know that.
How about Jerkface, I said. It's what I've been calling you in my head. We can call you that.
No, we can't.
I heard a number of snickers, including one I was pretty sure came from Ned Nedder Strong, the taller of Jerkface's cronies.
All right, Cobb said, ignoring us. Now that you've done that, maybe we can talk about how to actually move somewhere.
I nodded, eager, though I realized nobody could see me.
Hold the throttle with a light touch, Cobb directed. Nudge it forward slowly until the dial says 0.1.
I did so, timid, extra worried that I'd repeat my embarrassment from earlier. And I let out a breath as my ship moved forward at a modest boost.
Good, Cobb said. You're now going 0.1 mag. That's a tenth of mag 1, which is normal combat speed. Even-numbered designations, you lower yourselves 300 feet. You'd be more used to saying 100 meters, but it's tradition to use feet for altitude for some scudding reason, and you'll get used to it. Odd-numbered designations, you go up 300. That will give you some space to try very slight moves to the left and right as you fly.
I did as he said, diving down, then leveling out. I tried a veer right and a veer left. It felt natural, like I was meant to do this. A series of loud alerts erupted. I jumped, then panicked. I searched my dashboard, worried I'd done something wrong. Finally, my brain put together that the sound wasn't coming from my ship or even from our room. It was alarms outside the building. That's the attack warning, I thought, pulling off my helmet to hear better. The trumpet sounds were different up here in Alta, faster paced. I pushed my head up through the canopy of my hologram and saw several others doing the same. Cobb had stepped toward the windows of our classroom and was looking out toward the sky. I could barely make out some distant falling debris burning in the atmosphere. Krell attack. The speaker on the wall crackled.
Cobb,
Admiral Ironside's voice said.
Do you have those Green Moss cadets hovering yet?
Cobb walked to the panel on the wall and pushed a button.
Barely. I'm still convinced one of them is going to find a way to make their ship self-destruct, even though POCOs don't have that function.
Great. Get them up, spread formation, above Alta. Cobb glanced at us before pressing the button again.
Confirmation requested, Admiral. You want the new cadets in the sky during an attack?
Get them up there, Cobb. This is a large wave. Nightmare flight is down in the city for R&R, and I don't have time to call them back. Ironside's out. Cobb hesitated. Then he barked out an order.
You heard the Admiral. Skyward flight. To the launch pad. Go.
Chapter 10.
To the launch pad? Now? After one day of flight training?
Cobb slammed a button on his desk, shutting down all of our holographic emitters. I couldn't help wondering if this was some kind of test or a strange initiation. Yet the pale look of Cobb's face persuaded me otherwise. He didn't like this. What in the stars was the Admiral thinking? Surely, surely she wouldn't get my entire flight killed just as retribution for Cobb letting me into the DDF. Right? We left the training room in a ragged jumble. "Rig," I said, falling in beside my friend as we jogged down the hallway, alarms blaring in the distance. "Can you believe this? Any of this?"
"No, I still can't believe I'm here, Spin. When they called me in and told me about my score, I thought they were going to accuse me of cheating. Then the Admiral gave me an award and took some photos. It's almost as incredible as the way Cobb let you in after..."
"Never mind that," I said quickly. I didn't want anyone overhearing that my circumstances were unusual. I glanced to the side and found Jerkface jogging a few paces away. He narrowed his eyes at me. Great. We burst out of the training building and gathered on the steps outside right as a flight of Fresa-class starships launched into the sky. One of the on-duty flights. There were usually several of those, along with another flight or two that could be called up in an emergency. So why did they need us? I didn't get it. Cobb emerged from the building and gestured to a line of 10 Poco-class fighters on a nearby launch pad. Ground crew were positioning ladders by them.
"On the double," Jerkface shouted. "To your ships. Everyone remember your number?"
Kimmelin stopped in place.
"You're 6, Quirk," Cobb said.
It was actually Quick?
"Get going, you fools," Cobb yelled. "You're on orders."
He glanced at the sky. A set of sonic booms exploded from the ships that had taken off earlier. Even though they'd moved far out, the booms still rattled the windows. I hurried to my ship, climbed the ladder to the open cockpit, then stopped. My ship. A member of the ground crew climbed up the ladder after me.
"You getting in?"
he asked. I blushed, then hopped into the cockpit. He handed me a helmet, then leaned in.
"This ship is straight out of repairs. You'll use it when you're on orders, though it's not 100% yours. You'll be sharing it with a cadet in another flight until enough wash out."
I pulled on my helmet and gave him a thumbs up. He climbed down and pulled the ladder away. My cockpit's canopy closed, then sealed. I sat there in silence, collecting my breath, then reached forward and tapped the button that engaged the acclivity ring. The dash lit up, and a hum vibrated through the ship. That hadn't been in the simulation. I glanced to the side, toward the mess hall I'd crashed into not 4 hours ago. "Don't stress. You just did this 100 times, Spencer." But I couldn't help thinking about what we'd discussed earlier. That cadets who crashed or ejected weren't, by tradition, allowed to graduate. I gripped the altitude control and waited for orders. Then I blushed again and pushed the blue button that turned on the radio.
"Anyone wave at her, maybe?"
Arturo's voice came through my helmet.
"FM, can you see?"
"Spin checking in," I said. "Sorry."
"All right, flight," Jerkface said. "Lift off, smooth and easy, like we practiced. Straight up 1,500 feet, then hover."
I gripped the controls and found my heart thundering inside my chest. First time into the sky. "Go." I lifted my Poco into a vertical ascent. And it was glorious. The sense of motion, the press of G-forces pulling me down, the view of the base shrinking beneath me, the open sky welcoming me home. I leveled off right when the altimeter read 1,500. The others gathered in a line next to me, stark blue acclivity rings glowing underneath each ship. In the far distance, I saw flashes of light from the battle.
"Flight roll,"
Jerkface said. All 9 of us confirmed back to him. Then we fell silent. "Now what?" I asked.
"Trying to call in for orders," Jerkface said. "I don't know the band I'm supposed to. I'm here," Cobb's voice said over the radio. "Looking good, cadets. That's a damn near perfect line. Except for you, Quirk."
"Quick, sir?" Kimmelin said. Indeed, her ship had gone up maybe 50 feet above the rest of us. "And I'm just gonna sit tight here, snug and happy I didn't crash into anyone. As the saint said, ain't nothing wrong with being a little wrong once in a while."
"Fair enough," Cobb said. "But I have orders from flight command. Flight leader, lead your flight up to 2,000 feet, then throttle to 0.2 mag and head, carefully, out past the city. I'll tell you when to stop."
"Right," Jerkface said. "Everyone, 2,000 and hover,
and I want you to stop sharp this time, Quirk.
Sure thing, Jerkface, she replied.
He cursed softly as we went up higher, high enough that the city below looked almost like a toy. I could still see the flashes in the distance, though the falling debris was more dynamic. Streaks of red fire, trailing smoke, falling right through the battlefield. Per Cobb's instructions, we inched our throttles forward and engaged the boosters. And just like that, I was flying. Really flying. For the first time. It wasn't fast, and I spent most of it sweating and overly cautious about my every movement. A part of me was still in awe. It was finally happening. We flew out toward the battlefield, but before we'd gotten very far, Cobb called again.
Halt it here, cadets, he said, sounding more relaxed. I've been given more information. You aren't going to fight. A problem with the elevators caught us with our pants down. One of the flights that was supposed to be on reserve got stuck below. They'll relieve you soon. Until then, the Admiral wants to make it seem like we have more reinforcements than we actually do. She sent you and another flight of cadets to hover close outside the city. The Krell won't fly in and risk engaging what they assume are fresh ships.
I nodded slowly, remembering one of Gran Gran's lessons. All warfare is based on deception, Sun Tzu had said. When we are able to attack, we must seem unable. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near. It made sense to use a few dummy flights to worry the Krell.
Sir, Jorgen said, can you tell us what is happening on the battlefield, so we can be ready, just in case?
Cobb grunted.
You all passed the test, so I assume that you can tell me basic Krell attack strategy.
I started to answer, but Arturo beat me to it.
When debris starts crashing down, he said, speaking quickly, the Krell often use the fall to mask their radar signatures. They fly low, underneath our larger AA guns, and try to approach Alta. If they arrive, they can drop a lifebuster bomb.
I shivered. A lifebuster would not only vaporize everyone in Alta, shields or no shields, it would collapse the lower caverns, burying Igneous and destroying the apparatus. The Krell don't always use a lifebuster, though, I said, jumping in. Those take a special, slow-moving bomber to carry them. They must be expensive or difficult to make or something, because the Krell often retreat the bomber if threatened. Most of the time, the Krell and the DDF fight over the falling debris. It often contains salvageable acclivity stone, which we can use to make more starfighters.
I suppose you might be right, Arturo said, sounding dissatisfied. But he asked for their basic strategy. The basic strategy is to try to destroy Alta.
Three out of four skirmishes never involve a lifebuster, I said. We think they're trying to wear us down, destroy as many ships as possible, since it's harder for us to replace them than it is for the Krell.
All right, Cobb said, cutting in. You two can show off for each other later. You're both very smart. Now shut up.
I sat back in my cockpit, uncertain if I should feel complimented or insulted. That seemed a common mix of emotions when dealing with Cobb.
Nobody in today's battle has seen a lifebuster bomber, Cobb said. That doesn't mean one couldn't approach. But today's debris fall does contain a lot of machinery with old acclivity rings.
Ha! I thought. I was right. I looked to see if I could spot Arturo to gloat, but couldn't make him out in the lineup of ships.
Sir, Jerkface said, something has always bothered me about the way we fight. We respond to the Krell, right? When a debris fall comes, we fly out to check it. If we find Krell, we engage them. Generally, yes, Cobb said. So that means we always let them pick the battlefield, Jerkface said. Yet the way to win in war is to surprise the enemy, to keep them off balance, to make them think we're not going to attack when we will, and vice versa. Someone's been reading a little too much Sun Tzu, Cobb said. He fought in a different era, flight leader, and with very different tactics. Shouldn't we at least try to bring the fight up to the Krell? Jerkface asked. Attack their base beyond the debris field, wherever it is? Why does nobody talk about that? There are reasons, Cobb said, and they're not for cadets.
Stay focused on your current orders.
I frowned at that, acknowledging, grudgingly, that Jerkface had asked good questions. I looked over my shoulder at the green proliferation that was Alta. Another thing struck me as strange. Cobb was an expert pilot and a first citizen. He'd flown in the Battle of Alta. If reserves were needed, even the illusion of them, why hadn't he come up here with us? We sat quietly for several minutes.
So, Bim said over the line, anyone want to help me pick a call sign?
Yeah, Jerkface said. I need one too. I thought we already decided on yours, Jerkface, Ned said.
You cannot call your flight leader something embarrassing, Jerkface said.
Why not? Hurl asked. What was that famous pilot with a name about gas or broken wind, I said.
One of the first citizens. She only recently retired, and she was an amazing pilot. 130 career kills. An average of 20 engagements a year.
I'm not going by Jerkface, Jerkface said. That's an order.
Sure thing, FM said. Jerkface.
I smiled, looking out of my cockpit toward FM's ship right beside mine. Had she known him before? I thought I could pick out a hint of an accent to her voice, the same one that laced the voices of the three boys, rich people accents from the lower caverns. What was her story? Lights continued to flash in the distance, and I found myself itching to grab the throttle, engage Overburn, and send my ship blasting toward it. Pilots were fighting, maybe dying, while I just sat here. What kind of warrior was I? The kind that crashed into the mess hall the first time she turned on her engines, I thought. Still, I watched those lights, tried to imagine the battle, and squinted to try to catch a glimpse of a Krell ship. I was still shocked when I saw one streaking toward us. I'd seen hundreds of depictions of their ships in art. Small, bulbous, it had a strangely unfinished look, with wires trailing behind like tails. It had a small, opaque, black cockpit. Most Krell ships exploded completely when damaged or when they crashed, but in some few, we'd recovered burned-out remnants of the wicked armor they wore. Never an actual Krell, though.
Jerkface, I said. Don't call me. Jorgen, flight leader, whatever. Look at your 11, down about 200 feet. You see that?
He cursed softly.
Hurl said, all right, the game is on.
It's not a game, Hurl, Jerkface said.
Instructor Cobb?
Here, what is it?
Krell ship, sir. It looks like it flew low, under AA gun range, and is heading for Alta.
Cobb didn't respond immediately. I sat, sweating, hands on my controls, trailing that ship with my eyes.
Flight command knows about it, Cobb reported back. Your replacements are climbing into their ships now. They should get here soon.
And if they're not fast enough? I asked.
What if that ship has a lifebuster?
Flight command has visual ID on its spin, Cobb said. The ship isn't a bomber. A single ship can't do that much damage.
Respectfully, sir, I disagree, Jorgen said. While the base is shielded, it could fire on the farmers with destructors, kill dozens before it's...
I know the capabilities of the damn Krell boy. Thank you.
Cobb took a deep breath.
It's close?
Yes, sir. Getting closer.
Silence over the line. Then finally...
You may engage, but stay on the defensive. No grandstanding, cadet. I want you to distract it until the reinforcements get into the air.
I nodded, nervous sweat slicking the sides of my head inside my helmet. I got ready to fly.
I'm on it, sir, Jerkface said. Netter, you're my wingmate.
Roger, Jorg,
Ned said. Two ships broke out of our line, and before I knew it, I had grabbed my throttle and zipped after them.
Spin, Jerkface said. Back into line.
You need me, I said. The more of us there are, the more likely we'll be to scare the thing off and back toward the real fighters.
And she'll need a wingmate, Hurl said, pushing out of line and tailing me.
No, no, Jerkface said. Everyone else should stay in line.
Take her, Cobb said. Hurl and spin. You're with the flight leader and his wingmate, but the rest of you hold position. I don't want you slamming into each other up there.
Jerkface felt silent. Together, the four of us flew in an intercept course, picking up speed, moving to cut in front of the enemy fighter before it could get too close to Alta. I was worried we wouldn't reach it in time, that it would zip right past us. But I needn't have been so worried, because the moment we drew close enough, it swooped around and came straight for us. Chapter 11. My pulse raced. My face went cold. But I realized, in that moment, that I wasn't afraid. I'd always worried that I would be. I talked big. I pretended like a champ. But how many fights had I actually been in? One or two scuffles with other kids when I was younger? Some sparring machos in judo classes? A part of me had always worried that when I got into the sky, I'd panic. That I'd prove myself to be the coward everyone claimed I was. Like the lies said my dad had been. But with a calm and steady hand, I eased up on the throttle and pulled into a turn, trying to position myself behind the enemy. I knew dogfighting techniques. I knew them backward and forward. I'd drawn them out in the margins of basically every set of notes I'd taken in class, regardless of the subject. I was still hopeless. I made the curve way too wide, and Hurl nearly smashed into me because we had banked at different times.
"Wow," Hurl said as the two of us recovered. "This is harder than it seems, eh?"
The Krell ship chose Jorgen to attack, letting out a blast of glowing destructor fire. I tried to help, but my turn was too sharp this time. Jorgen, Ned, and the Krell ship all zipped away behind me in a sequence of dogfighting maneuvers. I blushed, feeling useless. I'd always assumed I'd just, well, take to this naturally. But I struggled to get my ship even pointed in the right direction. The Krell pulled into position again behind Jerkface, who cursed softly and then did a near-perfect twin-S dodge. Suddenly all of this became so much more real to me. That was one of my flightmates, and the enemy was doing its best to kill him.
"Nice work, Jorgen," Cobb said, "but be careful with those maneuvers in the future. If you fly too much better than your companions, the Krell will immediately target you. If they can identify flight leaders, they attack them first."
"Shouldn't they attack the weakest pilots first?" FM asked. "The easiest to kill." But that wasn't the way the Krell thought. They always targeted the best pilots they could find, in an attempt to destroy our chain of command.
"I'll explain later," Cobb said, voice tense. "Ned, you need to stick closer to Jorgen if you can. Make the Krell have to worry about you tailing it if it tries to tail him."
It was fortunate the Krell focused on good pilots, because Hurl and I would have made easy target practice. We could barely steer. Jerkface, though, he performed a perfect Alstrom loop, almost losing the Krell ship. Unfortunately, Jerkface's next spin wasn't as masterful. He performed it well, but when he pulled out of it, he ended up accidentally pointed toward the rest of the flight. I heard him curse over the radio as he tried to swerve, but that sent shots from the pursuing enemy ship right into our team. They scattered, ships twisting in all directions. Bim clipped Morningtide, the quiet girl with the tattoos. Their ships bounced away from each other, but didn't hit anyone else. A few destructor blasts hit Rig's ship full on, but his shield held. He still screamed over the radio as the flashes of light rocked his Poco. I gritted my teeth, heart thumping as Hurl and I managed, finally, to head in the right direction. But that meant we passed among the scattering ships, and I nearly collided with Bim this time. Scud. I understood the Admiral's reasoning, but there was no way we should be up here fighting. At this rate, the only funeral pyres burned today would be our own. Poor Kimmelin had leaned on her altitude controls and had retreated some 500 feet below us. Jerkface barely kept ahead of the Krell, though he'd long since outpaced Ned. I pushed the throttle forward, and my ship compensated briefly for the G-forces, but after a few seconds they hit me, pushing me back in the seat, making me feel heavier.
"Where are those reinforcements?" Jerkface said, as the enemy fired on him, blasting at his shield. "Any moment now," Cobb said. "I may not have a moment," Jorgen said. "I'm going to try to get the ship to follow me up high so the AA guns can shoot it. Radio them." Done, Cobb said. The Krell ship's shield is still up, so you might have to keep it in AA gun range long enough for the gunners to score several hits. Okay, I'll try. What's this red flashing light on my dash? Your shield is down, Cobb said softly.
I can save him, I thought, desperate. I have to save him. The two had gained a lot of altitude. My only hope was to get there fast, to tail the Krell ship and shoot it down. So I pointed my ship's nose up and slammed my throttle forward, hitting overburn. The G-force crushed me downward as I flew up, and I felt myself grow heavier. It was the strangest sensation, far different from what I'd imagined. I could feel my skin pulling down, like it was going to slide off my face, and my arms grew heavy, making it difficult to steer. Worse, a wave of nausea hit me as my stomach was pulled downward. Within seconds, I started to black out. No. I was forced to grab the throttle and pull it back, slowing my ship. I barely managed to keep from losing consciousness. Below, the massive AA guns that protected Alta began firing, but they seemed clunky and slow compared to the zipping fighters. Explosions blasted the air behind Jorgen's little Poco and the strange, unfinished Krell ship. In a burst of light, an AA gun hit the Krell, breaking its shield, but it kept flying, right on Jorgen's tail. There was no way its next shot would miss him. No. At that moment, a single beam of pure light shot upward from below and pierced the Krell ship right through the center. It blasted apart in a flash of fire and debris. Jorgen let out a long sigh.
Thank the reinforcements for me, Cobb. That wasn't them, son, Cobb said.
Oh, Kimmelin said. Did I get it? I got it! Oh, are you okay, Jerkface?
I frowned, looking down. That had been a shot from Kimmelin. She'd positioned herself lower and over to the side, not to escape, but to get a good shot at the enemy without having to fire through the rest of us. I was, quite frankly, stunned. Jorgen sounded like he shared the emotion.
Scud, he said. Quirk, did you just snipe a Krell fighter from long range?
Cobb chuckled over the radio.
Guess the file is right on you, Quirk.
It's... she began, but then sighed. Never mind. Quirk it is. Anyway, yes, sir.
What is this?
Jorgen asked.
She's the daughter of AA gunners from Bountiful Cavern, Cobb said. Historically, people with good accuracy on the smaller AA guns tend to make good pilots. The rotating seats in the small AA guns accustom one to moving and firing, and young Quirk here has some very impressive accuracy numbers.
I wasn't even going to take the pilot's test, to be honest, she said in a conspiratorial tone. But the DDF recruiters showed up and asked me for a demonstration, so I had no choice but to give it to them straight. The best modesty is shown while bragging, as the saint said. And after they told me I might be able to do it, well, I'll admit I did get a tad excited by the idea.
Suddenly, her place among us made sense.
Vocals sound off,
Jorgen said, sounding shaken.
Status report, starting with anyone wounded.
Rig said.
I got hit. How hurt are you?
Just shaken, Rig said. Though I threw up in my ship.
Hurl laughed hard at that.
Rigmarole, return to base, Jorgen said immediately. Morningtide, provide him with an escort. Everyone else into line.
We obeyed, now far more reserved. The banter died off as we watched the firefight in the distance. But soon our replacements came up around us and spelled us off. Cobb ordered us back to base, and we accompanied the other cadet flight that had been used as fake reinforcements. We landed near Riggs and Morningtide's ships. The two of them had already left, perhaps to take Riggs somewhere to sit and calm down. He could get rattled easily. I'd have to find him and see if he needed someone to talk to. As we climbed out of the ships, Pearl let out a whoop of excitement and ran for Kimmelin.
Your first kill! If you hit ace before you're done with flight school, I'll hurl.
Kimmelin obviously didn't know what to do with the praise, as the rest of us gathered around, holding helmets and congratulating her. Even Jerkface gave her a nod and a raised fist of acclaim. I edged my way to him. That had been some awesome flying. "Hey, Jerkface," I started. He spun on me and practically snarled.
"You, we need to talk, cadet. You are in serious need of an attitude adjustment."
What? Right when I was going to compliment him? "Coincidentally," I snapped, "you are in serious need of a face adjustment."
"Is this how it's going to be? You insist on being a problem? Where did you get that flight suit anyway? I thought robbing corpses was illegal."
Scud. He might have pulled off some awesome flight work, but that face, I still just wanted to punch him. "You watch yourself," I said, wishing I had something to stand on to bring my eyes level with his. "When you are broken and mourning your fall from grace, I will consume your shadow in my own and laugh at your misery."
"You are a weird little girl, Spin."
"Little girl? Little girl? I..."
"Attention!" Cobb shouted, limping up to our gathering.
"Little girl?"
I seethed, but remembering how I'd been chewed out earlier, managed to keep my temper in check as I fell into line with the others. I pointedly did not look at Jerkface. "That," Cobb said, "was somehow the most embarrassing and inspiring display I've ever seen out of cadets. You should be ashamed and proud. Grab your packs from our training room, then meet me in Epsilon Hall of the Flight School building for bunk assignments. You all need to hose down and grub up."
The other cadets rushed off. I tried to linger, to ask after Rig, but Cobb ordered me on ahead. It seemed he didn't like people waiting for him while he limped. I still trailed after the others, feeling, well, like Cobb had said, actually, both ashamed and proud. I'd flown. I'd been in a battle. I was in the Defiant Defense Force. At the same time, my performance had been awful. For all my bragging and preparations, I'd been more of a liability than an asset. I had a lot of work to do. And I would do it. I'd learn. I was a warrior, as Gran-Gran had taught me. And the warrior's way was not to run from failure, but to own up to it and do better. As we walked down the building's hallways, the PA system cracked on.
"Today's flight was an incredible victory," Admiral Ironside said. "Proof of defiant strength and tenacity. Remember what you fight for. Remember that if the enemy manages to get a lifebuster bomb into range, they can not only destroy this base, but everyone below, and everything we love. You are the line between civilization and madness. In particular, I'd like to acknowledge the new cadets of the as-of-yet-unnamed Cadet Flights B and C. Their first sortie proves that they, with possible exceptions, are a group to be admired."
With possible exceptions. Scud. How could the admiral of the entire DDF be so petty? We walked to the classroom, where we'd left the packs of clothing we'd brought to Alta. As I swung my pack onto my shoulder, it banged into Hurl. The athletic girl laughed and made a wisecrack about how she'd almost crashed into me earlier, and I smiled. She seemed pumped up rather than discouraged by our performance. As we walked toward the hallways with the cadet bunks, Hurl hung back with me so I wouldn't have to walk alone. Ahead, the others laughed at something Ned said, and I decided I wouldn't let Ironsides get to me. I had my flight as my allies, and they seemed, Jerkface accepted, to be decent people. Maybe here, for the first time, I'd find a place where I would fit in. We reached the cadet bunks, two hallways with rooms all along them, one hallway for the guys and a separate one for the girls. Everyone knew that there were strict no-romance rules during flight school. No funny business was allowed until after graduation. Who had time for that anyway? Though I had to admit, Bim did look pretty good in a flight suit. I liked the blue hair, too. We went with the boys to check on Rig. Their room was almost as small as the one I shared with Mom and Gran-Gran back in Igneous. The small chamber had a stacked-up set of two beds on each wall. Arturo, Ned, and Jerkface had plaques on their beds, and Rig was already in the fourth one. A cot had been pulled in for Bim, poor guy. Rig was sleeping, well, probably pretending to, but that meant he wanted to be alone for now. So the girls and I walked back to our hall. We located the room assigned to us, and it was just as small and cramped. It had four beds like the boys' room, and each had a plaque saying who was to bunk there. Kimmelin, Hurl, FM, and Morningtide, listed by their real names. But I preferred to think of them by their call signs. Except maybe Kimmelin. Did she really want to be known as Quirk? I'd have to talk to her about it. Regardless, at the moment, I was distracted by something else. There was no bed or plaque for me. Not even a cot.
Well, that's unfortunate, Kimmelin said. Guess you ended up with the cot, Spin, once they bring it. I'll switch off with you every second night if you want.
That girl was way too nice to be in the military. So where was my cot? I looked down the hallway and saw Cobb limping up. Two men in military police uniforms stopped in the hall behind him, then lingered. Not advancing on us, but also conspicuously waiting. I trailed up to Cobb, leaving the others in the room. Sir?
I tried. They won't listen.
He grimaced.
No bunk for you. No meals in the mess hall.
What? I couldn't have heard him right.
You are allowed in my classroom. I get ultimate say over that. But the rest of the DDF disagrees with what I've done. I have no authority over the facilities, and they've decided not to allocate resources to you. You can train, you can, fortunately, fly a POCO. But that's it. I'm sorry.
I felt my face grow cold, anger rising inside me. How am I supposed to fly if I can't even eat?
You'll have to take meals down in Igneous, he said, where your family requisition chits will work. You'll need to take the elevators down each night, and then back up in the morning.
The elevators can take hours, I said. I'll spend all my free time commuting. How am I supposed to be a member of the flight if I can't live with the others? This is...
Outrageous, Cobb said, meeting my eyes. Agreed. Will you give up then?
I took a deep breath, then shook my head.
Good girl. I'll tell the others you were denied a bunk because of some stupid internal politics.
He glanced at the MPs.
Those cheerful fellows will show you the way out of the complex. And make sure you don't sleep on the street.
He leaned in.
It's just another fight, Spin. I warned you. They won't make this easy. I'll watch for a chance to fix this. Until then, stay strong.
Then he hobbled away. I slumped against the wall, feeling like someone had cut my legs off. I'm never going to belong, I realized. The Admiral will make sure of it. The MPs took Cobb's departure as their cue to approach. I'm going, I said, shouldering my pack and walking toward the exit. They trailed behind. I wanted to say goodbye to the others, but I didn't want to explain, so I just left. I'd answer the questions in the morning. Suddenly, I felt exhausted. Don't let them see you bend, I thought, walking straight-backed. The MPs escorted me out of the building, and down one hallway we passed, I was fairly certain I spotted Ironsides watching to see that I left. Once I was outside flight school, though, the soldiers left me. So much for making sure I didn't sleep on the street. Maybe that was exactly what Ironsides wanted. If I could get arrested for loitering, she might be able to have me kicked out of the DDF. I found myself pacing outside the building, not quite wanting to leave, not wanting to abandon the others and the sense of camaraderie I'd been imagining. Alone. Somehow, I was still alone.
I just can't stand it, Cobb, a voice said nearby.
Was that Jerkface? I inched closer to the building and looked around the corner. It was the back entrance to the school. And indeed, there was Jerkface standing near the doorway, talking to Cobb, who stood inside. Jerkface threw his hands up.
How can I be flight leader if they don't respect me? How can I give orders when they call me that? I have to beat it out of them somehow, forbid it, order them to obey. Son, Cobb said, you don't know much about the military, do you? I've been training for this my whole life. then you should know. Respect doesn't come with a patch or a pin. It comes from experience and time. As for the name, it started to stick. So you've got two valid options. Ignore it, roll with it, and hope it goes away. Or embrace it and accept it, to take away the sting. I won't do that. It's insubordinate.
I shook my head. What a terrible leader.
Kid, Cobb began.
Jerkface folded his arms.
I have to get home. I'm expected for the formal dinner with the ambassador from Highway Cavern at 1900.
Jerkface walked out to an extremely nice-looking vehicle on the street. A private hover car with its own small acclivity ring? I'd seen them occasionally down below. Jerkface climbed into the vehicle and started it up. The engine purred, somehow more primal than the smooth power of a booster.
Scud, I thought. How rich is this guy?
His family must have tons of merits to afford something like that. And that left him too rich to bunk with the others, it seemed. He pulled away in a smooth motion. It seemed distinctly unfair that the thing I was denied, he tossed aside like it was a bad bite of rat meat. I shouldered my pack, then trudged off. I left through the gate in the walled DDF compound, where another set of MPs marked my passing on a notepad. Then I trudged down the wide street toward the elevators. My neighborhood was at the far edge of Igneous, so I really would spend hours and hours commuting this way. Maybe I could find some place to stay nearer the elevators below. It still made me feel sick. I walked to the elevator complex, but there were long lines, probably because of the problems they'd been having earlier. I braced myself for a wait, but then turned and looked to my left, beyond the buildings, beyond the fields. Though Altabase itself had a shield and wall, this improvised town, full of farmers who were defiant in another way, didn't have a fence. And why would it need one? The only things out there were dust, rocks, and caverns. A thought took me. It wasn't far. I stepped out of the line to the elevators and walked outward, past the buildings, past the crops. Farmers working there glanced at me, but didn't say anything as I left the town behind. This was my real home. The caverns, the rocks, and the open sky. I'd spent more time here since Father's death than I had down in Igneous. It was about a 30-minute walk to the cavern with the crashed ship, but I found my way without too much trouble. The opening was smaller than I remembered, but I had my light line and was able to lower myself. The old ship looked more broken down than I remembered. Perhaps it was because I'd just flown something new. Still, the cockpit was comfortable, and the seat reclined all the way. It was a stupid idea. If debris fell above, I could get caught in a cave-in. But I was too hurt, too wrung out, and too numb to care. So it was that, lying in the improvised bunk of a forgotten ship, I drifted off to sleep.
Chapter 12. Waking up in the cockpit of a starfighter was basically the most incredible thing that had ever happened to me. Well, next to flying one. I stretched in the darkness, impressed by how much room the cockpit had. It was larger than those of the DDF ships. I engaged my light line for a little illumination and checked the clock. 04:30. 2.5 hours until I needed to report for class today. All things considered, I wasn't that tired, just a little achy from... Something was sitting and watching me from the inside rim of the cockpit. The creature wasn't like anything I'd ever seen in the caverns. It was yellow, for one thing. Flat, long, and kind of blobby. It had little blue spikes along its back, making a pattern against its bright yellow skin. It looked like a big slug the size of a loaf of bread, but thinner. I couldn't make out any eyes, but the way it folded up on itself, the front portion raised, reminded me slightly of a chipmunk? Like from the videos we'd watched in class of a few wildlife preservation caverns. What are you? I asked softly. My stomach growled. And equally importantly, I added, are you edible? It twisted its head sideways to look at me, though it still didn't seem to have any eyes, or a mouth, or, well, a face. It did let out a soft